This hearing of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, and the time is 3:31. We are in Butrovich Room 205. Members present are Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Giesel, and myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we have an overview from the Department of Health, which will include updates on SNAP and Medicaid related to the passage of H.R. 1. So in the room, we have Commissioner Heidi Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci. On the phone, we have Chief Medical Officer from the Department of Health, Dr. Bob Lawrence. Yes, we do. In addition, we have the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Jen Carson. She's here in person. The Director of Division of Public Assistance, Deb Etheridge, also in person. And online, we also have the healthcare policy our healthcare policy advisor, Leah Van Kirk. So we have a great team here today. Commissioner, would you and the Deputy Commissioner like to come forward and begin your presentation?
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. And so we will start on slide 2. So July 1st, 2022 is when there was the department reorganization, and that formed the Department of Health. And so I think of the Department of Health as the systems that support Alaskans across the state. And it is made up of 5 divisions: Seniors and Disabilities, Public Health, Behavioral Health, Healthcare Services, that includes our management operations of our Medicaid program and licensing and background checks, and then public assistance. Our mission is to promote the health, the well-being, and self-sufficiency of Alaskans. On slide 3, so in 2022, as we stepped into these roles, we went out to communities and we listened and really heard what the needs were as we formed this new department, and that really created these 4 arcs of effort. And over the past 3 years, we have provided updates to you as a committee on the 4 arcs of effort. And I think this weaves very nicely into the work of the Rural Health Transformation. Again, it's like, how are we meeting the needs of Alaskans? So the transformation of care is one of those arcs of effort. And we have a contractor that has been working with our providers, looking at the rate methodology for 4 different groups. It's behavioral health providers, ground transportation, long-term supports, and our federally qualified health centers. 2 of those reports are posted on our website, and then the other 2 are near finalization. On child care, we had the child care task force that wrapped up, and there was about 55 different recommendations from the child care task force. 56 recommendations, excuse me. And of those 56 recommendations, 40 of them are in process or complete. There's been a huge amount of effort into increasing access to quality child care. And actually, on slide 10, I'll do a deep dive into what those efforts were over the past year. Protect, rescue, and restore life, that's all about preventing overdoses. And there has been a lot of work in that space with the opioid settlement funds that have come in. We have used that funding to grant out to organizations across the state around interdiction. How do we keep the drugs out of the community? Prevention, treatment, and recovery. In addition, from 2023 to 2024, we did see a 5% decrease in overdose deaths. So clearly the work that we are doing, we are trending in the right direction. And then finally, our strengthening the behavioral health system. A couple of years ago, we did a pretty intensive focus on youth behavioral health, and we created a roadmap. We have a lot of the work that has been identified, and we have been working through shoring up so that our youth have access to services. And so what we have seen is we have fewer adolescents that are going out of state for care, which is good news. We are seeing an increase into calls for the 988 system for crisis support and then referrals for additional supports. So again, I think that our trending is going well for strengthening our behavioral health system.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll just note we can pause any time for questions. We have a question from Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm really curious, as you both know, that safe gun storage is something I'm really passionate about, and reducing suicide and self-harm in our rural communities. I know as part of the FY26 budget, DOH chronic disease and health promotion had requested money for a gun safe storage media campaign that unfortunately had been vetoed. Was the campaign able to find additional funds or resources? Were there an ability to bring information to our communities about safe gun storage?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I would have to follow up. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. Senator Kiesel.
Commissioner, where do you get your data about behavioral health and drug overdoses and things like that?
Through the chair, Senator Kiesel, I would actually refer that question to Dr. Lawrence.
Dr. Lawrence, if you're online, did you hear that question?
He's searching for the unmute.
Yes.
I just unmuted the chairman. For the record, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence, Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health. And I'm sorry, the question was broken up a little bit. I couldn't hear Senator Giesel's question.
Senator Giesel, would you repeat the question, please?
Yes, Dr. Lawrence, the commissioner commented that we're seeing less overdose deaths. Where are you getting that data from? Perhaps it's from emergency rooms, I don't know. But are you also getting behavioral health outcome data, and from whom?
For the record, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence, through the chair, Senator Giesel. The data regarding the overdose deaths would come through our state medical examiner's office, and that number of deaths is something we follow each year. As Commissioner said, there was a 5% drop between 2023 and 2024, and so that's information that we'll continue to track through the Division of Public Health. Regarding the second question, we'll have to get back to you on the connection between that and behavioral health data.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is probably for Dr. Lawrence. Once again, good to hear from you. I see that the dashboard for the Alaska Opioid Data Dashboard was last updated May 3rd, 2025. And I'm curious if there has been anything in the last 8 months, trends that we should be aware of or information that might be worthy of highlighting here.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence again. The trend that we see in 2025, that data is not finalized, and actually, unfortunately, because of the lag in data, we'll have final numbers towards the end of the year, but the preliminary data shows that the trend is still in the positive direction.
Very good. We have a question from Senator Klayman.
This is a follow-up on the question Senator Giesel asked. How are we doing on overdose deaths compared to national statistics in other states?
So again, for the record, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence, through the chair. Senator Klayman, Alaska in general has higher rates, and I believe you were asking about the overdose death rates. Our overdose death rates remain higher than the national average, and while we've seen those numbers fall in the rest of the country over the last several years, Alaska, thankfully, is now starting to see that downward trend.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Klayman. So nationally, they've seen a 27% decrease. And Alaska has seen a 5% decrease. And when we look, we take a step back and we look at our data, Alaska typically trends after the lower 48 when we start to see some of these changes with overdoses or some of the other public health initiatives. And so it's an aggregate number of 27%. It does vary between each state.
And then
go ahead, Senator.
Same question for Dr. Lawrence about behavioral health outcomes, how we're doing in comparison to other states.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Kleinman, I'm not prepared to answer the question on behavioral health. I would defer either to my colleagues there, or we can get back to you.
Yeah, in the room, we have Jen Carson, the director of the Division of Behavioral Health. Would you like to ask them that question, Senator Kleinman?
Whoever is best able to answer. I don't know who's best able to answer.
Oh, Deputy Commissioner Ricci, would you like to answer that?
Through the chair, Senator Kleinman. For the record, this is Assembly Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. I think it depends on how you measure it. We were looking at some kind of measures that Medicaid released at a national level a few years ago, and in some of the key measures, particularly follow-up, access to a behavioral health provider following an emergency room visit or something like that, we were actually trending faster and higher than other Medicaid states. But when you looked at statistics related to 1 week, we were below other states and had not moved the needle yet. But if you look at some of the changes that have occurred over the past 2 or 3 years, we are starting to see improvements, at least from that measure. Looking at the number of youth who are in out-of-state facilities, we track that very closely. We track it on almost a weekly, if not monthly, or monthly if not weekly basis. And so those numbers are data that is coming from youth who are tracked in our system, where we can see the decrease over time.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Senator Kleinman. Let's move on to slide 4.
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So we're going to highlight in the next few slides some of the operational updates within each of the divisions, as well as what they're looking at for next year as we move forward. So for the Division of Senior and Disability Services, the NRI implementation has been a core focus of the division for several years, and we appreciate the support from the legislature and stakeholders. We think about this as kind of a foundational change to how individuals on waiver are able to direct services themselves. So this NRI tool is an assessment that will allow individuals to move towards something called person-directed care, where they can use the funds that are available to them through waiver services and decide kind of how best they can use those, what services can best meet their needs.
Deputy Commissioner, for the viewing public and for forgetful legislators, can you remind us what NRI stands for?
Through the chair, NRI is actually the name of an assessment tool. It does not, to my knowledge, it does not stand for a higher level acronym. So in order to move to a system where an individual can effectively engage in person-directed care or person-centered care, it requires a different type of assessment tool for what those needs are than what we have in place today and what our current assessment tool is. And so the NRI is an assessment tool that's been used internationally, developed by a nonprofit agency. It's used across multiple different states that allows for almost like a modernization of how we conduct our assessments. So we intend to roll this out over all of our 5 home and community-based waiver services. And again, we have appreciated support from the legislature in helping fund both positions and the capital necessary to support this tool. Last year, the division focused on conducting the procurement and working with CMS and engaging with a contractor that can start to build out the software so that we can apply this tool for different waivers. That contractor was selected in the fall, and they began a kickoff. They're called Mon Ami. And they're working with 15 other different states on similar projects right now. So that's been going well. As we look ahead to what the work the division will be doing in 2026, they're really working to begin implementing kind of a soft launch of the NRI assessment tool for 2 of the different waivers. Again, part of their strategic plan is to implement a soft launch with the NRI assessment at the same time they're maintaining ongoing assessment tools, just to make sure if there's a change or a difference, we understand what that is, what that means for the individual, and if the tool needs to be tweaked a little bit. So, but you will see that soft launch happening this year, and that's a big step for the division. One of the other items that the division focused on this year was working with the commissioner's office and our contractor Guidehouse, as Commissioner mentioned earlier, to complete a rate methodology study. Again, we heard that long-term care services and support rates didn't always match the evolving need that we see within our state, particularly related to individuals who have more acute or complex care conditions. So that study was completed this fall, and the division is working with Guidehouse and working with stakeholders to understand how to think about the findings of that study. All of these studies really lay out a series of different policy considerations and financial considerations that can be developed or can be implemented over a series of years. And so I think about this as providing the framework that the department and stakeholders and the legislature can have over the next several years about how to think about implementing different recommendations to achieve the goals of the system that we want. And then finally, the division has worked very hard on implementing changes to help meet the needs of individuals with complex care. I think that is an area within our state that we are really seeing an emerging need and a gap in kind of both an adequate continuum of care and services to address. So the division worked to make adjustments to create more flexibility for higher acuity rates for different time periods, or to allow and support different kind of flexible arrangements for individuals who may need two staff to support them during some periods of the day versus 24 hours. So those are some of the changes that were underway.
I'll just pause. Note for my colleagues, we will be hearing from Guidehouse, I believe, next week. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a hearing with Guidehouse next week. We can ask questions about these studies.
Yeah.
Please continue.
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. Moving forward, one thing that I wanted to highlight for the committee is that we have five home and community-based waiver services, and those are on a five-year renewal period with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And we are at the end of the renewal period for four of those five waivers. So the division has been undertaking the process over the last several months of renewing those waivers. Everything is on schedule and going as planned. I think the public comment period for those waiver renewal periods just wrapped up either last week or this week. Those will all be summarized, they will be published, and the division will work with CMS to complete renewal by the end of June 2026. But that represents a significant amount of work within the division that's critical, so I wanted to highlight that. Also wanted to highlight one last item on this, which is that the division is always looking for ways, again, that it can help meet some of the needs of the people it serves. And so they started a pilot project. This is only 60 days old, working with a company called RingMD. And RingMD provides telehealth or virtual services that are specifically focused on individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so this is a service that providers or individuals or family members can access, again, 24/7 to receive specific advice or care for what their needs are. Again, it's a pilot project and it's new. We're not even 60 days in yet. So far, about 51 people have signed up for it in January, but we will be reviewing this pilot over the next 12 months and then evaluating what next steps are.
Very good.
So moving on to slide five, the Division of Behavioral Health has also been very busy this year. As we talked about earlier, we completed the rate methodology study for behavioral health services. And again, we'll be talking about that with the legislature in more depth next week. But that was a large work of effort. And when I step back and think about the behavioral health system and what we heard when we started in these positions, is we heard a lot of frustration with the Medicaid program and the inability of providers to fully realize the services that were available under the 1115 behavioral health reform waiver. So we identified three different approaches that we thought could be foundational to helping that. The first was to ensure that our claims were being administered timely. So we transitioned claims system to a new, we transitioned claim systems back into the MMIS last fall. The second was to look at how behavioral health services are being paid. Is the underlying methodology, does that make sense? Does that support what the providers need and the outcomes we want to see? And then the third is to support technical assistance. So you'll see this year in our operational update, we've addressed the rate methodology study, and we will be working to implement those recommendations at the end of this year and the beginning of next year. We are also working to build out technical assistance this year and into next year. Another area of focus for the division is preliminary implementation for certified community behavioral health clinics. This is an area of focus for us, and I know the committee has been interested in that in the past. We received a $1 million planning grant from SAMHSA last year to begin the planning for implementation of these clinics. And we worked with Alaska Behavioral Health in Fairbanks and JAMI here in Juneau. We are planning to submit a application to be part of the next cohort for the demonstration beginning July 1st. So that application is due April 1st. And if we are elected to be part of that cohort, then we will begin the implementation. We will start with two organizations and build out from there. It is a five-year demonstration, but we are excited to see this work move forward. And then finally, the division has also been focusing on building out the crisis continuum. There was a study that was completed earlier this year about different ways that we could continue to build out the crisis continuum. And the division is working to implement that. We also completed our subacute licensing regulations. It took a long time. We know getting it right is important. So I think we went through three rounds of public comment before we finalized those. And those will be taking effect either last month or this month. So we will now be working with at least two providers that we know are interested in opening up these subacute facilities in Anchorage. Those are both crisis stabilization and crisis residential services.
Just to pause for a second, is that the facility that's opening at or near ANMC, South Central Foundation, does that fit into this category or is that a different kind of service?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, we are speaking with South Central Foundation and both Providence, who have expressed interest in standing up these facilities in the past. And I have received legislative support from that in past years. So these regulations were critical to being able to move forward. I would also say we've incorporated crisis recommendations into the behavioral health rate methodology study as well, because that was something that we heard was that the crisis rates that were developed didn't necessarily match the needs and the expenses. Now the providers were working on building out the model further. So we made sure that Guidehouse worked and met very closely with some of these crisis providers so they could incorporate that in their rate recommendations.
Very good.
Okay, moving to slide six, we're going to move into the...
I'm sorry, Deputy Commissioner. I thought you were going to the next, the moving forward that slide. Yeah, I have a question there after you've gone through those bullets.
To the chair, moving forward, we're working to implement the behavioral health rate recommendations, and we are also looking to apply for certified community behavioral health clinic demonstration. So again, the application would be April 1st, and we would begin the demonstration July 1st. We are looking to expand provider technical assistance. So within the rate methodology study, there were some areas where I think our contractor identified opportunities for, I think, a little more support with some of the billing practices that would allow providers to be able to receive income for services that they are owed, but there may be some things that you need to do to take care of that. So, for example, updating your rate charts to make sure that those reflect the updated amounts, things like that. So a Guidehouse will be reaching out and working with some of kind of a targeted approach initially to work with some of those entities where they identified immediate opportunities, but we will be broadening that over the next year. And then I've talked a little bit about the crisis services expansion and the subacute facility launch.
Thank you. I have a question, Deputy Commissioner. So, you know, I have a bill and we've had an active conversation about mental health or behavioral health parity in billing. And that's not parity in the amount, but rather in the administrative burden. And so I'm wondering which of these points, if any, speak to that, or if there are any other efforts to move forward towards a more streamlined system for behavioral health vis-a-vis traditional health services.
Chair Dunbar, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. Yes, it is not a bullet on this slide, but it should be. I don't want to say we ran out of room because we could have made the font smaller. But that is an area of focus for the Division of Behavioral Health. And some of it ties into the AO360 regulations project, where we want to see if there are opportunities within our regulations to streamline or remove some of those, particularly because when we have conversations with behavioral health providers, I think a significant amount of concern is actually with how the regulations are written and the level of detail that is contained in those regulations. So that's an area that we are actively looking at. In the next slide, I'll talk a little more about service authorizations in general and the next steps within the Division of Healthcare Services. But the Division of Healthcare Services will be working to implement a new service authorization module, and that is an opportunity for us to review all of our service authorizations and evaluate what is appropriate to maintain, what we may need to change, and what we might be able to reduce. So I see those two as aligned.
Very good. Senator Klayman.
Going back to the discussion about crisis continuum, besides Anchorage, are there some efforts going on in the Matsu Valley and other parts of the state to implement some of those facilities?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, there are. And one of the aspects of the crisis continuum that emerged in some of the contractual work that the division did last year is that we need to build out maybe a better system for how to support place-based crisis services. So not every community and not every type of crisis service will occur in kind of a subacute facility. We know that there are community organizations and there are entities that are able to provide crisis services of a slightly different type in different settings. So how do we build that out over the next year, and how do we align that with the reimbursement framework so that we have the full continuum of crisis services?
Yes.
I thought that Juneau and the Matsu and maybe Kotzebue were all taking steps to at least bring in crisis intervention as opposed to crisis residential, and checking where you are on that.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes, those conversations are happening. And I think that's part of the work that the division wants to do, is to make sure that we've really built those out thoughtfully. Because right now we've been so focused on kind of the crisis stabilization and crisis residential from a facility perspective. We know that we need to build out kind of the in-between levels of crisis services for some of those communities that you mentioned as well.
Thank you.
Women, please continue.
Thank you. Moving to slide 6, we're going to talk about the Division of Healthcare Services. They have also been busy. Again, I think about them as kind of the heart of the Medicaid program. They kind of keep the blood flowing, and in this case, the blood is the operational work that has to happen. So enrolling providers into the Medicaid program, they manage what is now a $59 million average weekly check write for the Medicaid program, so weekly payments to providers, and nearly 10 million annual processing, nearly 10 million claims annually. So they are a small but mighty division. Over the past 2 years, we've really focused on increasing retention within the division. In July of 2023, we had a 31% vacancy rate, and as of last month, that vacancy rate was down to 8%. So we've been successful in addressing that, and that's important because they're working to do a lot. We know that we need to modernize our systems in a way that is not disruptive, but allows us to move from technologies where we're still relying on people to push the button and move the things forward. And we need to bring in some of the new systems where we have both automation and self-service capacity. So we are taking a modular approach to doing that. And we are starting with the provider enrollment portal. So we know the provider enrollment has been a pain point operationally for several years now. We are planning to begin implementation and go live of a provider enrollment portal that will allow people the ability to self-service, upload documents, see where their application is at, and have that work in a different way than we do today. Today, the system we have relies a lot on like email boxes, even behind the scenes, going from person to person, physically going in and checking national databases for certain information. And a lot of that can be automated now. So in the next year, we'll be going live with a new provider enrollment portal. We are also in the same vein. We are looking at launching our mobile app in the next, 2 to 3 months, where individuals will be able to have their Medicaid ID card on their phone. So it'll be a digital Medicaid ID card. We are also, at the same time, we're looking at the provider enrollment portal. We need to do the same thing for service authorizations. These are also prior authorizations for anyone outside of the Medicaid program. We have federal requirements that align with some of the legislation that I think was passed last year regarding prior authorization requirements and timeliness from the legislature. There's federal requirements that align very closely to those, and we are working to implement those federal requirements. But to do that, we need to bring in a new service authorization portal. So our team is getting, I think, the final blessing from CMS right now, and then we will be issuing an RFP so that we can procure a service authorization portal and work to implement that. So these are, I get excited about this because I think these are core to when things work well, it allows us to focus on the bigger picture versus the daily operations, and we need to make sure that our technology is supporting us. Another kind of in the weeds but core issue that we have heard for years is something called multi-rendering provider enrollment. And what does that mean? That means that if you are a provider offering one type of services, the way our Medicaid system is structured right now, it's very difficult for you to also provide a different category of service. And that can be a problem, particularly in some of our rural communities where individuals may be providing personal care assistance, but they may also be doing other work. And so this has been a longstanding issue we've heard about from many of our providers. To make changes to this, I think about like our Medicaid system is like a house. And this kind of change involves like knocking down a structural wall and moving a fireplace and like, you know, creating a new room. It is a foundational change to the structure, which is why it hasn't been fixed for a while. But our team has been working over the last year to make those changes and those fixes. They're doing it very carefully because you don't want to mess anything up. And those are beginning to roll out in the last 3 months. I think there was a soft launch with phase one, and phase two will be rolling out in the next few months. So again, longstanding operational items that we're hoping kind of eases the friction sometimes that happens between providers trying to build Medicaid and our systems. And then finally, background check efficiency. We have managed to increase our background check efficiency, and we have dropped our provisional time to just over one business day. And so that's almost a four-day reduction in that time period. So again, this always fluctuates. Some of it is staff dependent. Some of it is dependent on other variables, but it's headed in the right direction.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
So on the background check, is it still a paper process, or are you using electronic fingerprinting?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. Right now, for healthcare services, for medical services, it is still paper. I know that we are working on the digital approach with child care providers, and I think depending on how that works, we will be able to pull it into the healthcare side.
Thank you, Senator Giesel.
Moving on to the right side of this slide, moving forward, I've talked about the provider enrollment portal. I've talked about implementing the service authorization portal. I would love at some point in my time with the Department of Health to move away from paper travel vouchers or coupons to a digital format. So that is next on our list. I don't have information on exactly what that looks like right now, but that is a priority for the division. And then we also really want to improve our analytics, including analytics for fraud, waste, and abuse reporting, but also better insight into the spend that is happening within our Medicaid systems. We have teams of incredibly dedicated individuals with a lot of subject matter expertise and knowledge that we rely on to understand what is happening with our spend. But with the evolution of technology and analytics, I think there are some ways where we could have faster, better access to our data that's maybe more comprehensive than what we're able to do today. So our focus next year, again, is going to be on moving away from paper travel vouchers and really looking at how we can incorporate better analytics.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you piqued my interest when you talked about moving away from paper travel vouchers. As obviously growing up in rural Alaska, I'm often surrounded by folks who still really appreciate their Nokia flip phones. So I'm curious about some of the understanding of research that you have done as a department around, would this actually save costs, or would you only be moving a very small amount of folks to some sort of digital application and still have to maintain the paper?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. I think there will always be a need for paper of some sort. I think right now, though, we rely on it almost as a primary form for people across Alaska, and I think we would like to see that change.
We have been working on providing some more flexibilities or changes, ways where administratively some of the things that we're doing don't make sense and they don't save money. And we've been working with some of our tribal health organizations to look at facilitating some of those changes through their work. And so I think to your point, we've been working very closely with them and have a state plan amendment right now that actually we're working on with CMS that would incorporate some new changes. Again, recognizing things like Uber and Lyft are transportation options that people use. So how do we make sure that we are leveraging those as options that are available to our Medicaid population? Now, that doesn't address the needs of rural Alaska because not everyone will have Uber and Lyft, but we kind of want to make sure we're encompassing what's new, but making sure we can maintain what works for people who don't have access to all of the services that you would see in like Anchorage or Juneau.
Thank you. If we go to the next slide, Deputy Commissioner, and if it's possible to move a little bit quicker through these, because I would like us to get to the conversation about HR 1 and its impacts that starts on slide 11. But please continue through here.
To the chair, I believe Chief Medical Officer will be speaking to this.
Dr. Lawrence, are you there to speak to slide 7?
Again, good afternoon. For the record, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence, Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health. That brings us to the slide on the Division of Public Health, which is a division made up of just under 450 permanent full-time staff led by Director Lindsay Cato, providing a wide array of services. I'll be brief, but there are, by way of this operational update, just a couple of things we wanted to highlight for you. First is, as we said earlier, the overdose deaths have declined by 5% 2003 to 2024, and things continue to move in the positive direction. The division is not backing down on our prevention efforts, and so we continue with the distribution of the overdose reversal kits, including the kits that are now stocked in each public school. We're working with other departments on the expansion of the prescription drug monitoring program so that prescribers are alerted when individuals present to an ER with non-fatal overdose. And the Overdose Fatality Review Committee, which is now set up, is generating actionable strategies. Second of all, we've upgraded our electronic laboratory information management system and taken steps to modernize public health nursing. 80% of laboratory reports are now generated and submitted to providers electronically, which is a welcome move out of the paper-based system. The work of our public health nurses is now documented on an electronic health record, which standardizes things across the state. And excited to report that the TB program has adopted and implemented the use of an EDOT, which stands for Electronic Directly Observed Therapy. That's technology that does not take the place of a human being, but helps us with facilitating the connection between patients with TB with providers who are overseeing their treatment. Finally, on that side of the slide, we are connecting residents experiencing homelessness to services through a new mobile vital records issuance process that over this last year has been very well received. If I can go ahead and just say, looking ahead, the division is strengthening out our capacity for infectious disease surveillance and response, particularly in the areas of TB and syphilis, as well as other emerging infectious diseases. And the division is working with community and tribal partners across the state to ensure that people are connected to treatment and outbreaks are prevented. After hearing from our communities in a statewide effort, our public health centers are now transforming to adapt to community needs, providing standardized services across the state, while also moving to co-locate multiple state services, preferably in the same location. And then finally, we recognize it as an essential service to Alaskans that provides critical data and information regarding the causes of death. The division is building out advanced technologies for our state medical examiner's office. So in each of these ways, the Division of Public Health continues to guard the health of all of our communities.
Thank you, Dr. Lawrence. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Lawrence, I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the state medical examiner's office.
Director Cato and I had the opportunity to travel with the Alaska Mental Health Trust to some rural communities, and they brought up some of the barriers that they're experiencing, particularly when someone in the community passes. How has the work in that particular area been going, especially to help folks when they're in their most time of need?
Yes, through the chair to Senator Tobin, thank you for highlighting that. The work of the state medical examiner's office is vital to our neighbors across the entire state. And as you mentioned, there can be delays when a person passes and the state medical examiner needs to help with doing the postmortem exam. And there can be just times that are required for, you know, transports of individuals' bodies and then also getting reports back out to communities. And so that that work is ongoing and improving. And I would say this last year, because of upgrades in both technology and then, as I said, building out the work of the state medical examiner's office, your point, both well taken, and I think in answer to that point, our goal is to make sure that every family is able to reach closure, regardless of where they are in the state, as quickly as possible, and that that state medical examiner's office truly is a service to the state.
Follow up, Senator Tobin.
Very brief. I would love to follow up offline, as I know that there was some things identified by our tribal partners that I think we could continue to work upon.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Dr. Lawrence, I have a question. So we've seen in some other parts of the country a falling rates of vaccination and rising vaccine skepticism, partly driven by misinformation and disinformation on social media, and sometimes even from officials. I'm wondering, have we seen a concomitant fall in rates of vaccination here in Alaska?
To the chair, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence with the Department of Health. Answer to the question is yes. We see, just as you see across the whole country, there are, particularly in certain areas, a reduction in the rates of vaccination coverage. The reasons for that are multifactorial, and there are many contributing factors. But I would say the trends that you're hearing about and seeing nationally, we also see in Alaska.
Well, thank you. And I mean, we've seen measles outbreaks now. There's one ongoing, I believe, in Texas. I know there was a case of measles in Alaska, I believe. What is the division doing to try to reduce that trend towards fewer vaccinations?
To the chair, this is Dr. Robert Lawrence. The ongoing work within the Division of Public Health is focused on making sure at several levels that individuals who are making decisions about vaccination have accurate information. We also encourage individuals to speak to their healthcare provider. And so we do a lot of work to educate our healthcare providers and provide recommendations that are specific to Alaska. It's important to know that while national guidelines will come out from national bodies, the responsibility for adapting and implementing vaccine policy and vaccine recommendations for the state really falls to us as a state, looking specifically at our history of infectious diseases and particular pressures with ongoing transmission of disease. And so all of that taken together is a way of saying that we recognize that there's not a one particular effort or initiative that is going to increase vaccination rates in any given area, but rather it's about providing good information, good support, and most importantly, connecting people to a trusted source of information when they're making that decision.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Lawrence. I won't harp on this any further. We can go on to the next slide, but I will say that I think the Division of Public Health needs to be thinking about, I'm sure you are, but redoubling efforts to address a change in the environment. That is to say, we've been doing things one way, and it's been relatively successful in getting folks to get vaccinated. We are in a different information environment now, and it seems like things are trending in the wrong direction. And I don't think that is because of the state of Alaska or the division. I think there are external forces that are convincing people not to get vaccinated or have their children vaccinated. And we should be thinking seriously about new strategies to counteract those forces. But I won't go any further. If we could go on to the next slide, please.
for the record, Heidi Hedberg. So on slide 8, I'm going to talk about the Division of Public Assistance. I'll provide just a brief overview on operational updates and the focus for the coming year. The division has had a strong focus on streamlining processes, really leveraging our IT modernization, and we're starting to see the fruits of that. So we are now serving more Alaskans than we have in prior years, and we continue to improve our timeliness. And so as you can see, and as an example, last year we were at 60 days. Now, actually, as of last month, we're down at 43 days. So serving more Alaskans, continuing to improve our timeliness. Part of that is our IT modernization efforts, and I will provide an overview in the moving forward and the next slide. We are on track with all of our IT modernization efforts. In addition, as an example, the Alaska Connect portal we launched last year so that Alaskans can complete an application, upload documents. This spring, we will launch the second phase, and that allows Alaskans to actually track where their application is at if the division is waiting on additional documentation for their application or whether they need to schedule an interview. So it's increasing that transparency. We should see a decreased volume to the virtual contact center as Alaskans are leveraging more of the Alaska Connect portal. And we are seeing, you know, as an example, when we launched our SNAP online application well over a year ago, 80% of our applications are submitted online now. So we have a decrease in paper submissions, which is a benefit. In addition, you notice something called DPA in a box. It is a team of eligibility technicians that work with a community. They go out and they help, they meet Alaskans and help them complete their application, whether they require to do an interview and make a determination. So we launched this last year. We went out to Kotzebue and to Delta Junction, and it was very successful. And so we are working with communities as they invite us out, again, to communities that do not have a DPA office. In addition, there has been a lot of federal changes, and we'll talk about HR 1 at the end of this slide deck, but there's a lot of policy changes within CMS or within USDA, in addition to a federal shutdown. And that had significant impacts to this division. And I really appreciate the division and the leadership and how they managed through those ever-evolving changes while keeping clients at the center. So clients were, the impacts were minimized to the clients. And then finally, eligibility technicians, that job class series, there is a study that was launched to evaluate that series. It takes about a year to evaluate that class series, looking at the work that they do, the current pay structure, and if it's commensurate with the work duties that they're doing. This has been a job class study that has been in the wings for many years, and we're excited that it launched. And this summer is when we should hear what's the goal. The hope is that this summer we will see the completion of that study.
Commissioner, I have a question before you go on to the next point. A few months ago, there was an article in the ADN about using out-of-state contractors to process SNAP applications. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that and then say, is that something that the division plans to do going forward? Is that an indefinite sort of plan, or was it a one-time thing?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, to the chair. So we were working with USDA, the federal agency, on SNAP and looking at our contractors that support the virtual contact center in helping with a SNAP application. I do have Director Etheridge here, so she can talk about the details, but the article was talking about the demonstration project, and that was it's still in process with USDA. I don't believe that it has been fully approved yet.
Yeah, Director if you could please come put yourself on the record. I'm also curious what the time frame will be on that project. And, you know, generally we don't have out-of-state contractors doing what is kind of a core state of Alaska function. So can you speak to, you know, is this going to cause any problems with our existing contracts?
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance, and to the chair, I'll first talk about the what's called a non-merit demonstration waiver, which we applied for through Food Nutrition Services at USDA, and we received approval for that, and we signed the terms and conditions in October, late October of 2025. Through that contract and terms and conditions, we have phases. We're currently in essentially phase zero, and what that means, that's our planning phase, where we are identifying, stepping back in the terms and conditions, they specifically named our contractor, Public Consulting Group, PCG, who's supporting the Virtual Contact Center. And so that becomes important because that's how that individual's non-merit staff were selected in order to work on this demonstration project. In phase zero, we are training those virtual PCG staff, a small number of PCG staff, just like we train state staff on processing a SNAP case. And we are in negotiation right now with FNS on our sample plan. There's a high level of oversight for the state of Alaska. We're one of the first states to receive a demonstration to use non-merit staff to support the work of our SNAP program. So we're in negotiations with them on our sample plan and our reporting so that I think we're close to final. And we've been training those, I think, 10 PCG staff to process SNAP. Our goal was to begin the SNAP merit, non-merit work with merit work with non-merit staff in February. I can pause, but I'd also like to say that the plan is not to be ongoing and forever with this body of work. My goal will always be that the state of Alaska, the Division of Public Assistance, employees are processing SNAP cases. This is really targeted in order to get the support in order for us to address our untimely work at the Division of Public Assistance. And so while it, you know, we've seen great improvements with SNAP, we do know that there's other areas that we require some improvement in timeliness. And in order to, if we have support in the SNAP processing, then that allows my merit staff to also work on those other areas to see system improvement and timeliness improvement in those programs. Through the legislature, received appropriation for an additional 15 FTEs. And we're in the process of hiring those. We have the management portion. We've created them. We're interviewing for them and the management portion. Those are really designed to start the transition from that contract or those contracted non-merit staff into a fully state-staffed program.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any follow-ups on that? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. You use a lot of acronyms. So I wrote down FNS, PCG, non-merit. If you could please help break these down so that the public can follow along.
Thank you for that. Again, this is Deb Etheridge, through the chair, Senator Tobin. FNS is Food Nutrition Services. They are under the U.S.
United States. Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, the Department of Agriculture. Thank you very much. The PCG is Public Consulting Group. They are the contractor we've contracted with to provide the support to our virtual contact center. So if I said VCC, that's what that stood for, Virtual Contact Center. I try really hard not to use acronyms, but was there another one? I feel like there was.
I think the what's a merit staff versus non-merit staff, it's a new term.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. A merit staff is a person who is hired and supervised by the state of Alaska, and they have what's called merit principles.
So we have quality oversight and hiring practices that we follow, and therefore the state of Alaska, the staff that we hire, meet those hiring principles as far as merited staff. And then a non-merit staff would be someone who is not an actual state staff employee. And so what was really predicated on our ability to get the approval is that public consulting group hired the staff following the same merit-based principles, but they're still considered non-merit staff in that definition because they're not actual state employees. Is that helpful?
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Tobin?
I just want to make sure that I follow. So with non-merit staff, it would sort of like be as though we hired someone from Idaho to provide support and services. They don't live in the state, but they are supporting your department in this virtual contact center. Am I getting any of this correct?
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, yes, they are hired through a contractor, through a contract, and we remain directly oversight and supervision of the body of work that they conduct and do. So they're responsible through a contract.
Very good. Senator Klayman.
It's a lot of words and a lot of acronyms. The question that I think the chair asked was, do we have an out-of-state contractor that's processing the benefits? And it sounds like the answer is yes, but you're on a path to bring all the effort back in-state. Have I got that right?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes.
And a short follow-up.
Go ahead, Senator Klayman.
What is your timeline on when it'll all be back in state?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that's a good question. I think my timeline is really predicated upon our ability to become timely and get benefits out to Alaskans in a timely manner. It's a multi-pronged approach. Our timeliness is not just based on leveraging merited, non-merit staff. We also have a number of technology improvements, which have already actualized into allowing us to become more timely.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. And I apologize to the committee for taking us down that road, but there had been some news coverage of it, and it's good to get some more specificity. Thank you, Director. I don't know if Deputy Commissioner wants to continue. Was it you, Commissioner, if you want to continue with moving forward on slide 8?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll make it brief. Just to share with you, the division moving forward, this spring they will be launching an all programs application. So many of the programs will have a single application, and that's easier for clients. What won't be included is childcare, burial assistance, or heating assistance. We have a contractor. They are working on moving the Medicaid program off of our legacy system, so that is underway. Our SNAP modernization module, we're going to be launching, we're issuing an RFP this spring. And the work assistance tool is for our eligibility technicians. It will have all of the policies and procedures with an agent, a little chat bot. And so the eligibility technician will be able to submit their application or their question, and then it will be able to pull from the policies and procedures. So it's a tool to help our eligibility technicians with the consistency of the answer, and then they're not having to flip through all of the paper or legacy tools to find the information. So again, it's a tool to help our eligibility technicians.
Very good. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that all program application, are we concerned that we might see people applying for more programs at once, especially ones that they may not be eligible for, hence taking up more time, which, I mean, having a electronic tool, I'm sure that's going to speed things up, but then might this be a little bit counterproductive at the same time?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that is a great question. It's a smart form, electronic smart form. So when you say yes, it's going to pull up the additional questions to verify if they meet the the eligibility for that application, and it's going to prompt people. So if they're applying for SNAP, they're going to ask, you know, maybe about Medicaid. So there's going to be some prompting that will happen. One is to ensure that the clients are receiving all of the information. It's to help consolidate the amount of applications that are coming through.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, I just want to draw your attention. We talk a lot about IT modernization within the Division of Public Health. So this is a visual representation of what the Modernization Office is working on. So at the top, I just want to draw your attention. That orange banner lists all of the Division of Public Assistance programs. You can see on the left-hand side, those are the families. Those are the clients. They're going to be accessing and applying through the Alaska Connect portal, which is what I just talked about, or they can call the Virtual Contact Center. You can see down at the bottom, there is our eligibility technician. They are going to be having one area that they log into that will be connected into all of the various programs that are represented in the bubble. We're looking at the conformity, the single easy access point so that our eligibility technicians are not toggling between various programs. And we want to make sure that we have consistent information. So there's just a lot of work that the division has been doing with the data integrations and shifting off of these legacy platforms into a new modular integrated eligibility program. And final note on this, we are not going to call it permanently the Integrated Eligibility System. There will be a naming contest, and so it will be called something different in the future.
I propose not SAP. go on, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I ask, what is Spirit Web or Current or Qualtrics? There is just some words here that I don't know what they mean.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Tobin. So just highlighting real quickly, these are the names of the program. So Spirit Web is our family nutrition, our energy cost offset system. That's our heating assistance. Child care is our child care program. Qualtrics, that is a system that tracks all of our corrective action plans. It also has a survey tool. Quality Assurance is a program that accesses this information. You can see the EIS, Eligibility Information System, and ARIES. Those are our two current legacy systems that will essentially go away as they're morphed into the Integrated Eligibility System. Random Moment Samples, so all of the staff have to do, if they're working on multiple programs, they have to do timekeeping, so they document if they're working on SNAP or Medicaid. The Mobius View Direct repository, that has all of our warrants and some reporting in there. Current is the name of the workflow system that tracks the work of our eligibility technicians. And iLinks is our document management system. And then the Instant Eligibility Verification System, IEVS, is connected into the Department of Labor, the Social Security Administration. It is checking and verifying income and employment.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner. We can go on to the next slide.
So, for the record, Heidi Hedberg, on slide 10, there's been a lot of focus on child care, and we really appreciate the legislature and the appropriation of funding for child care and the passage of Senate Bill 95. So just very quickly, because I know we're short on time, last year we did launch our new child care information system. So that is for child care providers, and it is also for parents, and is also for our staff. And what we are seeing is some child care providers are now able to get a license within less than 30 days, and it used to take months. So we are seeing some really good progress. There's a tool that if parents qualify, it links them to the assistance application for child care. So it's a user-friendly system to support families. We did receive funding last year to increase the base funding formula for our child care grants. The last time it was updated was in 2012. And so as of November 1st, we updated the base rates, and we are also focusing in on our infant care. So we have a pay bump for providers that will increase the number of infants and toddlers that they are caring for. Senate Bill 95 passed. That increased the eligibility, so more families qualify, up to 105%. It also capped the parent copay from 10% to 7%. And it created two positions that are really focused on supporting the business sector so that they can create on-site or near-site childcare. And those two positions, one is in recruitment, one is being drafted for to be posted for recruitment. On the other side, the moving forward, I would just share with you, there is a new provider type. It does not exist in Alaska. It's called friends, families, and neighbors. I think this is going to be a provider type that's really going to impact our most rural communities. And so if a family qualifies for a child care subsidy and they identify a family, friend, or neighbor that then passes the safety requirements, they are registered with the state, essentially that they could receive that subsidy. That's the connection between the two. So that means there's a lot of discussions to look at how we develop that provider type, but that's going to be a focus of our child care program office.
Commissioner, will that require a statutory change?
To the chair, no.
Okay.
And then child care workforce subsidies, that's really targeting those child care providers who have infants and toddlers in child care. Looking at how we can provide a subsidy to augment how much they are paying for their own child care.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner.
So for the record, Heidi Hedberg, on page 12, we're going to transition and start talking about HR1. That passed July 4th, and there are changes to the SNAP and the Medicaid program. So what I want to talk a little bit on slide 12 are some of the changes that we are planning for. So on SNAP, the work requirements are changing. So the age range is changing, and it's extending it from 55 years to 64 years of age. So now anyone that is 18 years to 64 years of age will need to meet those work requirements. In addition, there are state penalties for payment errors, and that is beginning in federal fiscal year 28. So states that have a payment error rate above 15% will have to pay a percentage of the SNAP benefits. For historical context, in Alaska, we had a high payment error rate of 60%, and now it is down at 24%. So we are improving and decreasing our percentage, and our goal is to get below 6% so that we do not have to pay for an additional for a portion of those SNAP benefit rates. For all of the states that goes into effect in 2028, we are going to be applying for a waiver to extend that so that it buys us more time while we work on our IT modernization, our workforce, and streamlining our process, which I think we've discussed today. And then finally, the administrative cost sharing for the state. It used to be 50-50 for paying for the administration of these federal benefits within SNAP. Now it is shifting to 75%, 25%.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have two questions. So I have some data from the Food Bank of Alaska. They provided this to me. I think it's public, actually. We found it. So that administrative cost shift, they estimate it will be $47.5 million a year. And I'm wondering if that is in line with your own estimations. If not, what is your estimate of what that cost shift will be? And is that cost shift built into our budget? Or I suppose you say this isn't, is this going to also not happen until 2028, or is this happening immediately?
So to the chair, the administrative cost shift does start in for state year 27.
So what we're budgeting for right now.
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. So the administrative cost shift, I think, already took...
I know.
I'll pass it over.
We have a lifeline from your division director.
Hold on, please.
It's good.
For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, director for the Division of Public Assistance. To the chair, the administrative shift occurs effective federal fiscal year 27.
Okay. And so remind me, does that mean it needs to be built into our state budget for 27, or are they on a different schedule?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So we are currently working through that, and we'll provide an update to the committee.
Okay. And yeah, I'm very interested to know if it has been built into our budget or into the governor's request. And so is $47.5 million, is that in line with what your estimations are?
So for the record, Heidi Hedberg, we will follow up with the committee on what the amount is of the administrative cost shift impact, that 25%.
A similar question, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues if they want. The food bank also estimates that between 4,500 and 6,900, so between about 4,500 and 7,000 Alaskans will lose their SNAP benefits because of HR 1. Is that a similar projection to what the division is expecting?
To the chair, this is Deb. For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, director of public assistance. I would say no, that is not what we're estimating in loss of benefit. The changes in HR 1 for SNAP, really to the able-bodied work requirements, there's a number of exemptions. And the state of Alaska was able to apply for what's called a good faith waiver to those ABOD, which we did apply for and we have for 1 year, but we can have that good faith waiver exemption until October of 2028. And through that process, we hope to be able to align our systems to make it simple for individuals to verify their work requirements and really implement a robust ABOD program, able-bodied adults with dependent children, without dependent children.
Sorry. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I kind of bristle a little bit when we say able-bodied, because there were particular exemptions previously for folks with SNAP that now are not allocated to this particular dynamic. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, as I think it's helpful for the folks to know. I appreciate the application for exemption. However, I still think the information should be made public. So I'd love for you to talk about the removal of exemptions for veterans, for folks experiencing houselessness, for folks who are aging out of the foster care system, the 10% dynamic, if our state has a higher rate of those who are unemployed and how we might be tracking that. And additionally, the removal of the exemption for folks who are caring for dependent children at all ages.
To the chair, again, this is Deb, for the record, this is Deb Etheridge. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, you did list the groups that were are no longer considered exempt. We do have some capacity to have discretionary exemptions, but that said, those are the removal. What isn't there is what has been expanded, in that Alaska Native, American Indian, California Native are also exempt from those work requirements, and that is current in our good faith waiver. We have already exempted those groups from the able-bodied work requirements. So to to be clear about that. And I think what you're saying is exactly why we applied for that good faith waiver. And I think that the administration understood that Alaska was going to experience some unique circumstances that we had to have the time to care for in order to ensure that individuals are able to access food if they need to. The removal of the dependent care starts at age, I think it's 14. And so anybody with a child under the age of 14 still has a dependent child and is not required under the able-bodied work requirements. And I can follow up with the committee on those specifics. I think that would be better in writing.
Yeah, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And just one follow-up, as you mentioned, that there is a new exemption for folks who are American Indian, Alaska Native, California Native. How is the department tracking that? Is that through how? How do you go about determining that someone meets those exemption requirements?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, right now we collect that information on our applications, but it's voluntary. And so we do require and we provide information to individuals that, you know, if you're Alaska Native, American Indian, California Native, you may be exempt from an able-bodied work requirement, and they can voluntarily provide that information to us, and that is how we're collecting it right now. We can't require that field on our federal oversight entities don't require us to require that field. Don't allow us.
Last follow-up. And I'm curious, as someone who is experiencing houselessness, is it just through attestation, or how would they provide that documentation to your department if they may not have their vital documents or tribal cards?
Through the chair, Senator Tolman, it is an attestation.
Very good. Senator Klayman.
Just going back to the state payment errors, and the goal is to be under 6%, brought it down significantly. Is there any history for us ever having been below 6%?
Thank you very much. Through the chair, again, Deb Etheridge, Director of Public Assistance, Senator Klayman. In years such as 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014, we were as low as 0.76%. In 2017 and 2018, we were closer to 7%. And then it rose post that.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Klayman. I'll just to put a pin in this. The food bank has their estimation. I understand we're applying for a waiver, but I would like, if you can provide in writing, the department's estimation, you know, trying to be realistic about if there's more administrative, if there, as we're changing exemptions, rather as the federal government has changed exemptions, and some of them require more attestation, you're going to end up having people slip through the cracks. And then some folks, you know, genuinely won't meet the new exemption. So I'd like a number if you're able to provide it. So we'll move on to, if there are no other questions on SNAP, we'll move on to the Medicaid portion on the next slide.
For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and we are looking at slide 13. So thinking about the impact of HR 1, I really think about the changes relative to the Medicaid program in three different buckets. The first bucket is changing financing mechanisms at the federal level, and that's really what this slide speaks to. The other two buckets include eligibility and enrollment changes, which we'll talk about in the next two slides. And then the third bucket is a number of other changes. We did not include kind of that third bucket in presentation materials for this committee, but we're happy to follow up, of course, at any time at the committee's convenience. So one of the aspects that I think is really important for individuals to understand and policymakers is that the bill does make changes to different financing mechanisms that states use to fund their Medicaid program. Specifically, two different financing mechanisms. One is something called provider taxes, and I think many of you on the committee have been involved in debates within the state about whether or not to establish a provider tax. Alaska is the only state in the U.S. that does not have a provider tax. And so these changes do not impact our how our program is financed today. The other financing change that occurred was something called state-directed payments. And these are this is a mechanism that states that have managed care organizations use to direct funding or payments towards specific entities or types of services. Alaska as well does not have any state-directed payments. We do not have any managed care organizations. So again, neither one of those funding mechanisms impact Alaska. At a national level, some of those funding mechanisms were important to support other states in how they provide care to rural areas or to maternal and child health. And so as states work through the impacts to their budget, I would anticipate that they are having some hard conversations in those areas. It can be easy to kind of confuse what's happening in other states with Alaska's Medicaid program. And we heard that initially from constituents who were concerned that there would be impacts to their services. And so I just want to highlight that for this committee and for anyone listening. Moving on to slide 14 and cognizant of the time, I do want to spend some time talking about eligibility and enrollment changes because those are areas that Alaska is working towards and that will impact Alaska. So there's new eligibility requirements, and these are focused on the Medicaid expansion population. And so these are individuals who are eligible for Medicaid as a result of income and not necessarily eligible through any other types of categorical eligibility. And in the in calendar year 2026, these are individuals who are making about $26,000 or more if they are a single household, or $35,000, just over $35,000 if they are a household of two. And so the bill makes changes to eligibility requirements and requires that able-bodied adults that are within the Medicaid expansion population who are between the ages of 19 and 64 complete 80 hours per month of work or other qualifying activities. And I will try to be really clear. I know there are a lot of questions about this. It can be very complicated, and we are working through getting answers to some of these questions, but everyone is, again, building this as we go. Those qualifying activities can include job training, education, or volunteer service. And, again, states are working with CMS to get more guidance in terms of details for what all of those mean. So we will share with you what we know today. Guidance will be forthcoming, and we will have more firm guidance by June of this year. The bill also allows for seasonal income flexibility. I know this is something that our delegation worked really hard on, given the number of Alaskans who have very seasonal jobs. And so the bill also allows averaged income over a six-month period to count as meeting that 80 hours per month if that income is sufficient. Individuals will need to demonstrate that they have completed 80 hours per month of these qualifying activities in the month prior to enrollment and in the six-month period prior to their redetermination. Another change that is taking effect is that redeterminations for this population, for the Medicaid expansion population, will occur every 6 months instead of every 12 months. So again, we have the addition of community engagement requirements as well as more frequent eligibility determinations. And again, this is focused on the Medicaid expansion population.
I have two quick questions, Senator Meyer, and we'll get to you. I know we've got a long list of exemptions on the next page, but I want to stay here for a second. Mm-hmm. The first is I have heard from a provider that if someone under HR1, if someone fails this not work requirement, but this engagement requirement, they are then locked out of the ACA exchanges. Is that true? Is there any interplay between this program and the ACA exchanges?
To the chair, Senator Dunbar, as written in the bill, an individual who fails to meet work, who fails to qualify for Medicaid because they did not meet the community engagement requirements would not be eligible for premium tax credits on the exchange. So that is an element of the bill.
I know you can't really answer this, but why? I mean, they seem like vastly different programs. The ACA is more akin to a private market. Why deny someone access to that?
To the chair, I can't speak to that.
And we have no flexibility in that at the state level. Is that correct?
To the chair, I would need to refer to the Division of Insurance regarding the marketplace plans and restrictions there.
Okay. We'll go to you next, Senator Meyer. Another question.
Thank you. So you talked about 6-month rechecks as opposed to the standard yearly. Do you anticipate a significant burden on your eligibility technicians? Are we talking about potentially changes to your budget or having to hire extra people for that?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that is one of the things that we are looking at throughout this whole process is what are the technical requirements, what are going to be the staffing requirements, what are the communication requirements to implement aspects of this bill. One thing that I have to put into context, the changes in this bill impact an estimated 71 to 72,000 Alaskans. Which is an important number. That's the size of our Medicaid expansion population. When we started in these roles, we and all other states had to undergo a process of reviewing redetermination or eligibility for every single Medicaid enrollee in the state. And that was about 250,000 individuals. And it took us about 2 years to get through that process. We did. So this will be a substantial work for the division. But it is not the same level of work as we undertook the last 2 years where we were doing a review of kind of the entirety of the Medicaid population. We also developed through that new tools, and those tools are improving, that allow us to leverage other data sources so that we can automate redetermination and renewals as much as possible. And we are actively looking at how we can use those tools to help inform individuals' ability or their qualifications for exemptions, which are on the next page. And the exemptions become critical because they are very broad. I mean, there are a number of different exemptions that could cover a substantial portion of the Medicaid expansion population. And I think Alaska, as well as other states, are looking to figure out how we can simplify the process so we can very clearly understand who is who must meet these community engagement requirements and who has an exemption. And so your question related to workload, it will increase workload, but to what degree really depends on how much we can effectuate our technology and our data sources to automate this as much as possible. And that is what our focus has been on as we've been preparing and building out for the last 6 months. And we've had a really great team that has kind of been working in the background for the last 6 months, tracking the guidance that CMS has issued and meeting with different contractors and different technologies to try to figure out what's going to be the best approach for Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Meyer.
Thank you. A little bit different question. So education, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, in college, you know, this kind of the standard full-time workload is 15 credit hours a week. The university still counts you as full-time if you're at all the way down to 12. But if you're just talking about in-classroom hours, then that is not going to meet the 80 hours a month. You know, that's going to be, you know, if you're only at 12, you're at 64. So are we telling people that they have to be, you know, taking very heavy class loads, or are they expecting, you know, can we combine education hours with job hours, or how does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, those are all questions that states are working through with CMS right now, because some of those details are really important to how we implement. I will tell you, when I worked in the Division of Retirement and Benefits, the retiree plan was one of the few plans that still had a restriction on coverage for dependents up until age 26, unless you were a student. So there aren't many plans that have had the experience of trying to understand those dynamics. What exactly counts as part-time? What counts as full-time in relation to different universities, different credit hours, different semesters versus quarters? And so, again, we are working through that with CMS and asking those questions. We don't know what those answers are right now. I do know that CMS is working to build out access to the National Scholastic Database, I believe, so that states will be able to automatically connect to that database to know, again, if an individual is considered a student. Where I suspect they will land, although, again, we don't have full guidance on this, is that it will be up to the university to determine. It will be up to the university regarding how they define full-time or part-time student, and that will probably flow into the whether or not they meet these requirements.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. If we go to the next slide.
Sure. Through the chair, just one more point, that these requirements become effective December 31st, 2026, but states may apply for a good faith waiver to phase in implementation through the end of 28.
And are we going to do that? Have we done that?
Right now, we are making a good faith effort to look at all of our systems and what the buildup will be. And if we need to apply for that waiver, we plan on doing that.
OK.
So there are a number of exemptions in these bills. And again, I know that our congressional delegation was very thoughtful about trying to make sure that Alaskans had the exemptions that they needed to make sure that these requirements are focused on people who are able-bodied and not on others. So this bill provides a series of mandatory exemptions and then optional exemptions that we'll talk about in the next slide. For mandatory exemptions, you can see if an individual or pregnant woman is or a woman who is within the postpartum coverage period, they are exempted from these requirements. Alaskan Natives or American Indians are exempted from this requirement. Individuals who have a significant physical, intellectual, or developmental disability are exempt, as are those who are blind and disabled. Individuals experiencing substance use disorder or a disabling mental health condition are exempted, as well as those who have a serious or complex medical condition. That also includes individuals who are medically frail. And I can tell you there's been a lot of time in the last 3 months spent at a national level, again, between Medicaid directors and CMS, as well as within different chief medical officers around the country, to come up with a definition of what medically frail would mean. There is the ability in the bill for states to submit kind of a variation of medical frailty to the secretary for consideration. But right now, I think CMS is taking a relatively firm approach with looking at existing federal regulations for that definition. So we'll see where they land, but we are tracking it closely. We are also veterans with a total disability rating are exempted, as are those enrolled in Medicare. So anyone 65 or older or anyone who qualifies for Medicare Part A or Part B. Individuals who are parents or caregivers for a child who is 13 years or younger are exempted, as well as parents or caretakers caring for someone with a disability. Individuals who have been recently incarcerated and were released within 90 days are exempted, as well as those under age 26, formerly in foster care. And that last bullet, it is individuals who meet SNAP or TANF work requirements. So needed to update that a little bit. One of the questions, again, states are looking at, and we are talking with CMS, is can we provide for a self-attestation upon that initial review? So if an individual believes that they meet any of the exemption requirements, can they self-attest? And then in that redetermination period 6 months later, can we either use data that we have access to within our systems, with permission, of course, from the individual, or other national data to basically verify that exemption? Again, we're trying to see if we can leverage as much as possible to make these systems automated. We'll be releasing more information, I think, later this month. But initially, I think we, in looking at the population, the Medicaid population and those that are potentially needing to require with community engagement requirements, I would say just about 2/3 of the population, we believe, would qualify for an exemption, and we would be able to potentially automate that exemption following verification. So again, we are working to build that out more, and we'll release more information as it becomes available, but we're really trying to take that approach.
So we're almost out of time. We're actually over time. I'll say this is sort of the heart of the issue, is how do people prove this? What kind of administrative burden is it to process this? And so we will certainly have either you, Deputy Commissioner, or whoever you feel is most appropriate, come and speak to us again in the near future, maybe when that information comes out in a month or maybe sooner. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is actually one that I think you and I both are pretty interested in. We know that 1 in 10 veterans is on Medicaid. We know that they are not necessarily 65 and also accessing Medicare. We also know that a total disability rating is not necessarily one that many veterans meet. They might be at 60% or 70%. So I'm very curious, as we know that as a population that often is overrepresented in experiencing homelessness and houselessness, some of the suggestions you might have on how we hopefully help this population, as I also represent Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson and have many folks in my district who I'm deeply concerned about with this particular dynamic that is about to really wreak havoc in our state.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. I think if we can briefly touch on the next slide, and then, like I said, we're already over time. We will hear from you again on this topic specifically.
Hi, to the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. So moving on to the next slide. There's a series, like I said, the prior slide was mandatory exemptions that all states must apply. This slide is optional exemptions that states can choose to apply. Alaska is choosing to apply these exemptions as we move forward. That is part of our plan. So individuals living in areas with high unemployment would be exempted, and that is defined as an unemployment rate greater than 8% or 150% of the national average. Those in federally declared disaster areas. Individuals receiving inpatient or residential care, and then again, this was a specifically for Alaska, those traveling for medically necessary care that is not available locally. We know that that's an issue in our state.
Very much so. All right. Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. Are there any final questions? Again, thank you, everyone, for staying late today. Thank you, Commissioner, and your team. Our next, let me see. I seem to have misplaced my script here. Next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, February 5th. We look forward to hearing HB 27, an act relating to medical care for major emergencies. It is now 5:05 p.m. and this meeting is adjourned.